I was reminiscing recently with a friend about Micah True, one of Boulder's great folks. I will be re-airing the previous interview in honor of Micah True, whose life was captured so well in Christopher McDougall's book, Born to Run. Micah passed away doing what he loved best, running in the wilderness, Mos Loco, running free. Hi, it's Robin with Tributaries. The Tarahumara Indians from the Copper Canyon area in Mexico are still running down deer. As a race, they were born to run, and as Christopher McDougall has discovered, the Tarahumara represent the little-known fact that humans are actually built to be the best endurance runners of all. Chris's book, Born to Run, A Hidden Tribe, Super Athletes and the Greatest Race the World Has Never Seen, parallels the vast and varied terrain covered by the Tarahumara by weaving a tale all on the heels, literally, of his main character, Boulder's own ultra runner, Caballo Blanco. Any runner will love this story, but as confirmed by the book's multi-week stay on the New York Times bestseller list, we all can relate to the soul of a people, the politics and shenanigans changing their lives, running shoe companies' elusive claims and marketing methods, and the heart of Caballo Blanco, who ran into more in life than he ever imagined. If you were tuned in last week during our drive, you may have heard the very first part of this interview. But Chris's story is so fascinating, I wanted to air the full interview uninterrupted, which includes an interview tagged on to next week's conclusion with Caballo Blanco. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. I'm wondering if you would just give us some background. Did it turn out to be the book that you intended to write? The book, of course, is Born to Run, A Hidden Tribe, Super Athletes, and the Greatest Race the World Has Never Seen. Even though I know Caballo Blanco, one of your main characters, after reading about 20 pages, I checked the paper to see if it was listed on the bestsellers lists for fiction or nonfiction. I wasn't quite sure where you were going.
It's nonfiction, and it was a total surprise to me, too, because every step of the way of researching this, I thought was going to be the last step. When I first went down there, I didn't think I was ever going to find the Tarahumara. When I found them and they wouldn't talk to me, I thought that was the last door closed. Then I found Micah, who opened another door, so it just was one sort of fantastic escape after the other that let the whole thing just keep snowballing along and along.
Yes, well, I certainly wish you good luck in finding another group of characters as brilliant for your next project.
It was bizarre. I mean, the night, and it took me a little while to even appreciate what was happening before my eyes, because originally it was just a massive pain in the butt, this unruly. That's one thing you tend to forget about people who are sort of eccentric, is that they might look good on paper, but in person, they take a lot of crowd control. And when this totally unlikely group turned up in El Paso at a time when I thought nobody was going to turn up for this race, all of a sudden I've got barefoot, motor-mouthed Ted, and I got the party kids, Jen and Billy, who drink themselves into a coma on the first night. And we had no idea if Micah was going to turn up at all, and it all bizarrely came together.
You know, that just leads so perfectly into this. It was like the perfect storm. And in those characters you just mentioned, you didn't mention that also the best ultra runner practically known to mankind also showed up to go down to Copper Canyon to run in this race. And I think that really leads into what you do bring up in your book about making connections instead of observing coincidences.
Yes, and that's a thing, too. And this was a lesson that I had to learn by mistake, by trial and error, because I think, like most people, if we're not good at something and someone else is good at it, we assume that they just got some kind of special advantage, that it's unfair. I've heard this over and over again about Kenyan marathoners, and they're always been these magazine articles written which suggest that, well, they got that special gene, or they got that special lung thing, you know, or some kind of a cell. And it's just not true. You know, we are genetically 99.9% identical. And if someone excels at something, it usually means that they have just done more to perfect that skill than we have, period. And that was my assumption with the Tarahumara Indians. I thought, well, you know, if these guys can run 100 miles in skinny sandals, and I can't run 5 miles in running shoes without getting hurt, they got some kind of a special foot. And the fact is, they don't. And this guy, Arnulfo Quimade, the ironic thing was, when I first was able to locate him, I was thrilled that at last I was at the feet of the master, and I was going to learn what the secret was that would allow me to run like him. And we sat face to face in silence for hours. He just wouldn't talk to me. So it came as an utter shock, and I have to say, an unbelievable testimony to Micah's credibility among the Tarahumara, that this guy, who wouldn't talk to me at all, traveled across the mountain to show up for his race.
Knowing Micah, it's no surprise he didn't end up down there by any coincidence or mistake either.
Yeah, you know, you think about that, right? People do make their own destinies, and I think that, right, he was smart enough to understand that the Tarahumara are more than just runners, that if you have a isolated group that's been untouched by modern civilization, and they have two main characteristics, those two characteristics are not a coincidence. If you have a group that is both fantastic at super long distance running and simultaneously is free from crime, warfare, violence, domestic abuse, clinical depression, cancer, heart disease, there's a cause and effect there, and he figured that out.
It's funny, because when you spoke about the Tarahumara, there was a book a while ago about a gorilla, and the gorilla talked about the takers and the givers.
Yeah.
In societies.
Uh-huh.
That certainly is hearkening, I think, back to the Tarahumara.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing, too, because after I met Caballo and the Tarahumara, and was able to really, I think, I like to say miraculously, although it was no miracle, but miraculously I was reformed from a broken down ex-runner who'd been told by some top sports medicine doctors that I should never run again. 9 months later, I'm easily managing a 50-mile race through really hard terrain. And it was after that that I started to dig into the history and anthropology of humans as long-distance runners. And there's one key fact, is that if humans are good at one thing, it's at sharing. We are among the most communal and cooperative. I know it's hard to believe, you know, in this day and age, particularly after all the thieves that have sort of plundered our economy for the past few decades. But the fact is, humans cooperate and they work communally. And the Tarahumara, I believe, are sort of last living representation of the best we can be and the best we once were. Because at a time when we relied on each other to survive and we relied on our ability to run long distances, you can't be greedy. You can't be hoarding stuff, because then you got to carry that junk with you. And you can't keep stuff for yourself. You have to share it.
Your book covers so many different facets of life, and that's, I think, why it's a bestseller. That, I think, is why I just enjoyed it so much. You bring in so much. Let's talk a little bit about some of these anthropologists that you've respected and researched and gotten to speak with a little bit. Let's talk about where you found this running down animals is not only still happening, but it's very, very possible. Talk about what goes on in Africa that you found out about this one man. His story is a book, certainly in itself.
It was truly a shock to me to find out that nearby, up at Harvard and the University of Utah, there are three scientists who have been slowly developing a theory over the past few years that humans are actually the greatest long-distance running animals on Earth, that we are way better than anything. Horse, gazelle, cheetah, you name it, we can whip its butt in a long-distance run. And that made no sense to me until I got a chance to spend time with them. And what they were looking at is there are certain mysteries of human history that to this day have never been solved. One of them is this: that 2 million years ago, the human brain suddenly exploded in size. You know, Australopithecus had a tiny little peanut brain, and then along comes Homo erectus with this big old, like, melon head. And a brain of that size, which sucks in a tremendous amount of caloric energy.
And the oxygen.
Yeah, and that brain could only have developed if that organism had access to condensed form of protein. In those pre-tofu days, you basically had to be eating an animal carcass, or a brain of that size could not have developed. So 2 million years ago, scientific fact, humans developed big brains. Problem is, the first weapon was only discovered, was only created about 200,000 years ago. So for nearly 2 million years, we are somehow killing animals with no weapons to kill them with. So that's the mystery. How are we getting the food without weapons to kill the animals? And one very strong possibility is that what we were doing was running animals to death. Humans can vent heat better than any other mammal because we vent heat through sweat. We perspire. Most animals vent heat by panting, which means that you run a horse long enough, eventually it's got a choice. It's either going to breathe or it's going to cool off, but it can't do both. We can. And so, again, the problem is this is a great theory. You know, it's a great thing right on paper, but until you can actually prove it, it doesn't mean anything. So what they discovered is that to this day, the Kalahari Bushmen in Botswana will go out on what's called persistence hunts, and they'll set off in a group, a hunting pack of humans. And they'll pick out a kudu or a gazelle, and they will literally run it to death. And what's so cool about this is the average time it takes to run an antelope to death is between 2 and 5 hours, which is exactly the average time of a marathon that people use to run a marathon, which suggests that there's, again, a cause and effect there. It's not a coincidence that tens of thousands of people show up in Queens on November 1st to go running 26 miles. That directly corresponds to our long ancestry of running animals to death.
Where do you think that marathon number came from initially? Do you know the history of that?
Well, I do, and there's this whole fanciful thing that, you know, Pheidippides ran from Marathon to Athens to announce the victory in the Battle of Marathon, and he died at 26 miles. the fact of the matter is humans have done long-distance races in that range, you know, between 20 and 30 miles. It was only at the London Olympics, which was back in, I think it was like 1902 or basically in the early 1900s, that the Queen wanted the long-distance event to pass by Buckingham Palace. So it left Olympic Stadium, looped around the palace, and went back, and that distance happened to be 26.2 miles. So the human instinct is to run roughly that amount of time, roughly 2 to 5 hours. We only institutionalized it by picking an arbitrary event that we thought was cool.
Going back a little bit to the human beings running down these animals, in the animal's defense, they do use various strategies. So, coincidentally, once again, it takes a community of runners in order to do this, because they'll go hide out in the shade and or within their pack.
Excellent. Yes, good observation. And that points to another mystery of human history that, again, has never been resolved. It's kind of fascinating that women, and I mean this respectfully, Robin, but you are a lousy sprinter. You are terrible, and your entire gender, you cannot sprint worth a damn. No woman can come close to even a high school miler when it comes to running the mile. You get to the marathon, and suddenly women are getting pretty good. You know, Paula Radcliffe is only 10 minutes behind the men's world record, and considering women have only been competing in the marathon for about 20 years, that is a sensational learning curve. But then you get into ultra distances. You get to 50 to 100 miles, and suddenly it's a coin toss. You take the best women and the best men, and you put them on a starting line of a 50-mile race, it's 50-50 who's going to win. Women can beat men, every man in the field, in an ultra-distance event, which leads to this mystery. Why is it that the allegedly weaker sex gets stronger as distances get longer? Then you add another element, too, is it's the same thing for older people. They found that men and women, it takes them 45 years before they start to lose their top-end speed. So if you reach your peak as a runner, as a marathon runner, at age 27, it takes you 45 years until you're back to running the same speed you were running at age 19 or 20. So only in long-distance running do we have a situation where men and women, old and young, can run at the same pace over long distances, which suggests that, we are genetically hardwired or engineered to run together as a pack.
Yes, and you do bring up the more evolved the species, the better the lungs. And then this other brilliant fact about all quadrupeds, that they do one stride and one breath, and we're capable of doing that differently.
Exactly. This is the cool stuff. And what I love about the scientists who are doing this research is that they're getting down and dirty to do it. These are guys who, right now, Dr. Daniel Lieberman at Harvard, he is the chair of the Evolutionary Anthropology Department at Harvard University. And when I say that, I imagine a man with, you know, white hair and a snowy beard on some ornate wooden chair. Well, instead, Dan Lieberman is out there in his bare feet running through Harvard Yard, or, you know, running down the streets of Cambridge, Massachusetts, to actually put his theories to the test with his own feet. And out at the University of Utah, doctors Bramble and Carrier were getting horses and bringing them inside and putting them on a treadmill. And the only way you can keep a horse running steadily on a treadmill is if you have somebody nearby holding the lead rope. So what does Dr. Carrier do? He just strips down a pair of shorts, grabs a lead rope, hops on another treadmill, and he's running side by side with this horse. And what they discovered were two things which were totally unexpected. Number one, the human actually had a longer stride than the horse. You know, it looks like horses have this really long stride, but they don't. Each leg actually does not travel very far. Secondly, what they discovered was the horse had this very metronomic one breath, one stride, one breath, one stride, whereas the human could alternate. It could basically, you know, shift gears with its lungs. It can go two or three breaths per stride, which gives it much more range of jogging capability.
In speaking about Harvard and scientists, those two words alone would sort of command a certain amount of respect. But the fact that they stuck a thermometer up a cheetah's butt definitely gave me new reason to respect a Harvard scientist.
Or not. I don't know. You know, it's a certain point where maybe a little less knowledge is all the better.
Yeah, actually, I guess that's true. Maybe there's a certain sense of insane bravery or desperation.
Or decorum, you know. But it's a fascinating thing. What they wanted to discover was just that. They wanted to see what exactly would happen if an animal would instinctively shut itself down when it approached hypothermia. So what they did was they took, you know, what they thought was the best runner on Earth, a cheetah, and stuck a thermometer up its butt and got it to run on a treadmill. How they do this, I've got no clue. But what they found is, pardon me, that most animals would have to have a fear of death in order to run itself to death. That when an animal starts to hit a certain core temperature, it just says, all right, I'm calling it a day. And that's what they found with the cheetah. No matter what happened, when it got to a certain body temperature after an hour of running, it just stopped dead in its tracks.
This is a little off course here, but what about whales? They're mammals. Has anyone looked into their breathing patterns and swimming? And
I am not going to be the one who puts a thermometer up a whale's butt. you know, it's an interesting question. I don't know if they've looked at, you know, aquatic animals. Even the whole running theory, this is all bizarrely brand new. You'd think that we would have known this stuff 50 years ago. But here's a fascinating fact, too, is that there's all this debate raging about running shoes and barefoot running. But the fact of the matter is no one has ever done a study to test whether barefoot runners get hurt more frequently than runners in shoes. And you'd think we would know this by now, and we don't.
Well, okay, then let's bring us into the next topic. Let's talk running shoes. And to quote, covering your feet with cushioned soles is like turning off smoke alarms.
You know, I'm afraid I can't talk about this topic, Robin, because I start getting so incensed that I just start to rave a little bit. I'll try to keep myself under control. I think the reason why I feel indignant is because listening to people defend running shoes is sort of like listening to a Republican administration talk about invading other countries, you know. You just know you're getting lied to. And what so infuriates me is that this deception has been going on for 30 years, and the studies which seriously challenge the whole reason for the existence of the running shoe companies have been out there for a long time, and they've either been ignored or marginalized or mocked by the very people who are supposed to be taking them seriously. So basically, it comes down to this. There has never been a study that has indicated that running shoes do anything to protect anybody from any injury. Okay, a total zero in the proof column. And yet all the time, you see doctors and sports medicine physicians and physical therapists and podiatrists and running shoe store salespeople telling you that you need to have this. You need to control the motion in your foot. You need to curb your pronation. It's nonsense. And what's fascinating, too, is you've never seen an advertisement from a running shoe manufacturer that promises that it'll do anything. They never say, hey, buy this shoe and it will protect you against runner's knee, or buy this model and you have a lesser chance of getting Achilles tendonitis. They won't say that because they know that there's absolutely zero proof.
Right. Well, the marketing world is it's getting busted all the time, and it continues to make huge strides. So it's very, very interesting world.
Well, I guess what bothers me is they're enablers. It's one thing, you can put out an ad about anything. What bothers me is when there is people in authority that you think you can trust, and then you find out they're not doing their homework. And the same thing happened, with the build-up to the war in Iraq was, where are the media watchdogs that were supposed to be challenging what was said? And I say the same thing now is, where are those media watchdogs who are saying, hey, it's funny, this shoe motion control is supposed to be really important. Where is any evidence that it is?
Do you have, I know you're going around and doing book talks and signings around the country. Are you catching a lot of flack? Are physical therapists or podiatrists showing up at your talks and saying, hey, what about this or that? Are you getting a lot of flack lately?
I wish they would. I'm actually dying for it because, frankly, so far, they've gotten nothing. And the only thing that really frustrates me is, no, I've never had a face-to-face debate with anyone. And I really wish they would, because I really think this is an unbelievably important topic. On the one hand, we're telling people that they need to exercise. On the other hand, there's been this sort of war on running. We keep telling people, it's dangerous. You need to protect yourself. Your knees are going to get hurt. So how can you tell people you should do this thing, but at the same time you're warning them that if you do, you're going to get hurt? Why would anybody do that thing? And I am really curious to find out where these physical therapists and podiatrists ever get the idea that the shoes are telling us to wear do anything. I want to know. There was an article in the New York Times about a week ago looking at barefoot running, and they quoted a doctor who has a reputation as being the best running doctor in the United States. He's a consulting doctor for the New York City Marathon. And he said, 95% of the people out there, if they run barefoot, they'll be in my office for treatment. And I actually left a message for him. I want to find out, where did you get that number from? Because as a scientist, you say 95%, you better have some data to back that up. I am convinced he just made that up. And that to me is shocking, that a person who's an authority is sending out a fear story based on a hunch.
Right. Well, I certainly am not going to defend him, and yet I feel at the same time, just by knowing Dr. Ralph Moss, who used to do an inner newsletter for all of the doctors at Sloan Kettering Cancer Hospital in New York, he ended up having to quit because I think rationalization is actually probably man's best tool. I think we can throw the wheel out the window. And, if you want to prove something, you can. You can follow a certain line of thought. Now, the validity or truth of it is another matter, but you can rationalize something to be true.
That's very true. And again, I can understand where that comes from. I think we have a wise human instinct for caution. You don't sort of pell-mell try every wacky idea that comes along. That's perfectly fine. It's perfectly fine for people like you and I to think that running barefoot is crazy. But where I really fault medical professionals is, again, they have been trained to be scientists. They've been trained to throw away prejudice and emotion and
right.
Fact.
And they are on a pedestal, so it's scary that people believe in them.
The funny thing is, though, Robin, is that the most lucid comment I've heard from anybody on the topic came from a guy named Vin Lanana, who was coach at Stanford. He's now a running coach at the University of Oregon. And what he said is exactly this. He said, I can't prove this, but it seems to me that when my athletes train in bare feet, they tend to go faster and get injured less frequently. And what I love about the fact is he said, I can't prove this. I thought, perfect. You know, he has no facts. He said that up front. And then he then goes on to report his observations. And he puts it in a way where I trust that he's telling me no more and no less than what he believes.
Yes, that's why another argument I could go on and on about is the double blind testing. That's just...
Yes, exactly.
So, well, you've become aware of so many amazing coaches, and the one that actually had a Colorado connection is so special. And I love that with him, linear thinking gets challenged with all of these greats.
Yeah, Coach Joe Vigil. And it's just so reassuring to be reminded once in a while that there are special people out there who get rewarded with a triumph for doing the right thing. And, you know, Coach Joe Vigil, he was a guy who I think intuited a long time ago that this whole communal aspect is, you know, you run alone and you're not going to be running for very long. That being a part of a group.
Unless you're Caballo Blanco.
Well, think about this, though. He doesn't really, you know, he's a loner, but at the same time, he seeks out groups. He sought out the Tarahumara.
That's true.
He sought out this very bizarre band of people for his race. And I think that, you know, in some ways there's probably a war within him as well. He doesn't know whether he wants to be by himself or with a group. But, so Coach Joe Vigil has always preached to his runners that it's all about compassion and camaraderie and working together and respect and treating running as an art and something we can all learn from each other. And again, he's been rewarded for this with sensational success and unbelievable devotion too. I happen to hear from one of his runners, a guy who ran for him over 20 years ago, called me up and said, hey, I just read your book and fantastic. And I talked to Coach Joe Vigil every couple of weeks. And I said, you're still in touch with your track coach from 20 years ago. That's the kind of loyalty he's engendered.
At one point in your book, you talk about crime, cholesterol, and greed.
Yes.
And as soon as I read it, it turned into crime, cholesterol, and greed. Oh,
my.
How did you figure that all in?
Well, you know, it was back to this notion that there are two things that the Tarahumara are sensational at. One is running, and one is superbly healthful lifestyle. And it struck me as curious that all the things that we are devoting billions of dollars and tons of worry to try to defeat in American culture, they seem to be immune from. You know, they don't have a crime problem. They don't have a cholesterol problem. They don't have a acquisition sort of credit card debt problem. They don't even have money. They don't even have a currency. And I thought, you know, again, I don't think this is an accident. I think that, you know, once you go back to first principles in any pursuit, you start to develop certain truths, and it just sort of locks everything together. I remember reading about Salvador Dali, the great surrealist painter, and one thing he kept stressing was, I spent a lot of years being a classical painter first. You know, I wanted to go back to first principles and understand how this art form should be used before I started to stray off. And I think the Tarahumara are our last living glimpse of what it was like when we had that old ideal of a sound mind and a sound body, that those two things have to go together. And the benefits are exactly what they've got. They've got all these things that we don't want to have, they're free from.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the Leadville race. Have you ever been to a Leadville race?
I've been in a Leadville race.
Okay.
And I ain't too eager to be in another one. Another example of my sort of idiocy and arrogance was that, you know, in September of 2005, I couldn't run 2 miles without getting hurt. And then 9 months later, I was very fortunate to be able to run 50 miles pain-free, which should have been good enough. But I got overly optimistic and thought, well, why not Leadville, which is, you know, 3 months later, let's go run 100 miles at 12,000 feet. Luckily, I was going too slow at the 50-mile turnaround and was told to stop, which was a life-saving decision. it is again, it's one of these sort of great treasures we have. It is this unique event which is based really on a sense of community. It is unlike most running events where no one really seems to care less who wins. And I've asked Ken Klober, the former miner turned Colorado politician who created the race. And you know, I asked about this because, you know, the Tata Rubana came up and actually competed in the mid-90s in Leadville and were sensational. You know, broke the course record and finished, you know, the top 7 out of 9 finishers were all Tata Rubana runners. But then they were basically never invited or encouraged to come back because of a falling out between the guy who was bringing them up here and between the sponsors of the race. Had a big old sort of shouting match. So I asked Ken Klober, I said, you know, it's bizarre. You know, any other event, the defending champion is always wooed and brought back and treated like a hero. And these guys, you couldn't seem to care less. And he said, I could care less about who wins the race. You know, winners come and go. And every year there's a different winner. I care about everybody else who's actually out there struggling. And I believe that's what defines the Leadville Trail 100. It's not about who's fastest. It's actually about who's slowest. It's about who's out there really fighting hard to finish this incredibly challenging endurance event.
Yeah, mentally, it's almost too much to fathom. You run this amazing over high mountain peaks, and then you turn around and do it again. If it was a straight-ahead 100, I'd have a better chance.
I remember being at the top of Hope Pass on a training run with actually Micah. He came up to help me train for this race. And we're at the top of Hope Pass, and we turn around, and he points like way back. He's like, see that way back there? That's the starting line. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. It just seems like it's off the edge of the planet.
And speaking about the Tata Rubana, when they ran that race, of course, they were all set up in this gear. I'm sure they all had their Nike shirts on and sneakers. And then within a few miles, they stripped it all off and just went into their own outfits and their sandals that they run in. But their diet during a race is another thing. And you talk about their drink. And is that cause for blood samples and doping?
No. You know, again, it's, you know, we try to outthink everything. And we usually come up with something that involves crap. You know, but the thing is that there are plenty of natural nutrients out there that are nice, slow burn, incredibly caloric food supplies. I should just sort of segue for a little bit. Scott Jurek, who's probably the greatest living American ultra runner, this guy's done sensational things. He's won Western States 100 7 times in a row, which is crazy.
Unreal, and, yes.
Yeah, and then he went off to set the course record at Badwater, which is 135 miles across Death Valley. Won that 2 years in a row. But, you know, Scott, I asked him what he eats during a race, expecting to get this whole sort of menu of high-tech stuff. He's like, I kind of like hummus. You know, I like hummus and adzuki beans and bean paste. And he goes, I eat real foods. Real foods digest nicely. They burn slowly, and they give you all the caloric energy you need. And likewise for the Tata Rubana. And for Micah, by the way, too. They like to eat pinole, which is ground-up sort of corn powder, and a drink called chia fresca, which is chia seeds, and the Mexican province of Chiapas is actually named for the chia seed, which used to be a great cash crop of the Aztecs. You get some chia seeds, soak them in water, throw in a little honey and some lime, give it a shake, and you've got this super-powered energy drink in your hand.
Tell us about wild geranium. That's also something they use quite a bit, isn't it?
Yes, it's a curative herb, and you know, I remember one magazine writing saying it's basically anti-everything. It's antioxidant, anti-cholesterol, anti-high blood pressure, that that the wild geranium, which is, you know, cultivated by the Tata Rubana, is just, again, one of these sort of natural medicinal stabilizers that a little bit will sort of take care of every ailment in your body.
Mm. Another thing about the Tata Rubana, socially and culturally speaking, is their, and I may not pronounce this correctly, the Tezquinadas?
Tezquinada, yeah.
Yeah. Could you tell us about that, and what's your hit on that? To me, it sounds like a very healthy pastime in a crazy sort of a way.
Yeah. I hate to be too sort of down on America, but you know, we keep trying to control stuff we shouldn't be controlling. And you know, when you live in a cooperative society, you can't afford to have grudges and nurture wounds in your heart. You know, you need to get stuff out once in a while. So lusts and longings and resentments, every once in a while, you got to sort of give vent, blow off steam, and then sort of reset the machine. And so what the Tarahumara do, because they're utterly reliant on each other, every once in a while, they'll have what's called a tezguinada. They get, you know, huge old buckets of tezguino corn beer, this homebrewed corn beer, and they get together and just pound it down, have a, you know, big old beer bash, and people just get so blitzed that next thing you know, wives are running off with other guys, and, you know, normally gentle people are bashing each other in the face, and there's sort of fights and sort of sexual mayhem erupting all over the place. I've never seen this in person, and I'm sort of glad I have it, because a guy,
because you would have been in the thick of it if you were.
Yeah, or else heading for the hills. But this guy named Bob Francis, who's a friend of Micah's from down in the canyon, this guy who's lived down there for years as well, he said that he was invited to a tezguinada, and he's probably the only person I've ever heard of that's ever been to one. And he said that, you know, these gentle old amigos of mine invited me to this tezguinada, and next thing I know, they're all up in my face, like bumping me with their chests, like trying to pick a fight. He goes, I could have been married or murdered 20 times that night, so I just got the hell out of there.
So, Chris, when you were writing this book, we started out with this question, and I'm wondering, how did the book turn out anything like you thought it was going to? Or are you one of those planners? And it was like, yeah, pretty much did.
Not really. What happened was that it's kind of a tricky question to answer, because initially I went into it thinking it's kind of a simple story. I was a hurt guy who's told not to run anymore. I discovered these fabulous runners and realized that this is actually what we're designed to do. And that means all of us, not just me, but everybody's designed to do this. But then what happened was, the more I researched it, the more I kept coming across these gold mines of fabulous information. I had no inkling that there was so much anthropological evidence out there. And I came across that. I had no idea that there was such a substantial case challenging the shoe industry, and that seems to indicate that shoes are actually the cause of the problems. I didn't know any of this stuff existed. And so early on in my research, when I started sort of compiling all this stuff, getting ready to write, I had this first moment of absolute glee, like, this is fantastic, and then of terror, thinking, oh my God, this information is so priceless that the only one who could screw it up is me. Like, if this book sucks, there's nobody to blame but me, because the material is fantastic. And that was probably the reason why the book ended up coming in a year overdue. It took me 2 full years of nonstop writing to get all this stuff together.
Well, as far and wide as the playground is for the Tarahumara, running all around and up and down and through this crazy terrain, your book very much does the same thing. But in a wonderful way. I mean, there's so many fantastic bits of information and little vignettes and stories about all kinds of things that make their way into the book. And, you know, you mentioned things like Lilith Fair. And this is a best-selling book. And I'm so happy to hear that a lot of the things that you bring in are things that people know about or they're excited to hear about. It's making the mainstream just broader, and I love that.
Well, thank you. I really had this feeling like hanging onto a roller coaster, that there's just, I was just along for the ride, that all I was doing was observing a lot of great stuff that's out there that is vibrant and going on and yet seems to get disregarded. And when you come across this stuff, you think, oh my God, how is it nobody's written about this yet? Like, what a lucky thing for me.
Mm. Well, somewhere in the book, I read that every great, and I think you're quoting someone else, if I remember correctly, every great cause begins as a movement, becomes a business, and turns into a racket. Now, after post-production of this book and publishing, where do you stand with all of that? And Micah, the Tarahumaras, and running marketing, etc.?
You know, that's an intriguing thing, because I don't want to be guilty of the same thing I'm accusing other people of, which is exploiting something and cashing in on it. And my hope is that what I ended up with, you know, one of the real difficulties of writing this book is, like, here you have all this fabulous stuff. Well, how do you organize it? What's the story? And it finally hit me. So I tried a lot of different ways to write this book, different ways of telling the story. And it finally clicked on me. Wait a second. This isn't my story. This is Micah's story. This is Caballo's story. And it has to begin and end with what his scheme is, what his plan is. And that, to me, is what the book is all about. And it's about this, is that he's a guy who set off to discover something that is incredibly valuable to us and to the Tarahumara. And when he discovered it, he had a choice. He can either, you know, keep it to himself and have a good time, or he can try and spread the word. But he had to learn how to spread the word in a way that wouldn't expose the Tarahumara to greater risks. So the plan he came up with, I have to say, at the time I first heard it, I thought was foolishly optimistic. But now, with hindsight, I realize this is a really brilliant idea he came up with, which is to put together a race down the canyons, but not the typical, you know, come down and kick some ass, you know, a sort of American-style race where it's, you know, one guy goes out for glory. He wanted to put together something that was very communal, where both groups could sort of learn from each other and trade secrets and ideas, and then test each other in this 50-mile race through the canyons. And his hope is that the runners from the outside who came down would go back and be able to tell the story of this fantastic wisdom that they encountered down the canyons. And likewise, the Tarahumara themselves would learn to really value this running tradition. There's only about 40,000 Tarahumara left, and very few still practice the ancient running tradition. And what he's hoping is that once this tradition becomes valued, that a sort of a UN sort of cultural zone will surround the Tarahumara, that they'll become a living legacy and will be protected and appreciated. And again, you know, as far as a way of protecting a people is concerned, that's kind of brilliant. And I hope my book accomplishes the same thing that Caballo is trying to do, which is just spread the word that this is something that people should value.
Right. And it's more about being the word. I mean, yes, it is Micah's story. And at the same time, he didn't know when he went to that first Leadville with the addition of the Tarahumara runners that all of this was going to transpire. So it's once again, it's the essence of the perfect storm. You know, when you can really be who you are and listen inside, then the right things happen.
That's right. You know, it's about, again, it's going back to first principles, figuring out what you value. And then when choices come up, you have a guidance system.
Do you have a spiritual practice?
Nah, I hate God. I was raised Roman Catholic. Just the way I feel toward shoe companies, I feel toward organized religion. I feel it's abused. And
right. Well, that's so totally different than a spiritual practice.
That's true. But again, I think there's no more fiery atheist than a former Catholic. So I don't have any kind of a spiritual sort of orientation point. But you know, I sort of just feel that the thing is, you know, just treat each other nicely, and that's all you really need to do.
Right. And something else you brought in your book, and maybe we'll just conclude with this. On the heels of you saying you have no spiritual practice, you mentioned there's a difference between telling a story and being self-indulgent. You mastered that in this book, I think. So there's a Zen, there's a big Zen part of you, and you can interpret Zen however you like.
Yeah, thank you. That was a good friend of mine who's a very good writer, and he pointed that out to me, and I kept it in mind that there's a difference between, you know, telling a story and also thumping your own chest. That you got to remember every time you choose to include a detail or tell an anecdote why it's there. Is it there just so you can show off, or is it there because you're really trying to pass on some information and illustrate something? So that was a great guidance principle.
Right. So what's on your horizon now? Are you planning the next book?
Yeah, I got this really cool idea in mind. I sort of want to take this idea of natural movement and explore it in some other ways. So the only problem is that I still feel like I'm a real student of this, that even what I've been discovering about running for the book is still, I'm still absorbing a lot. So I'm trying to find a point where I stop talking about this book and then start moving on to writing the next one.
Well, it'll probably happen right before your eyes, before you even are suspecting it's going on.
Right, I'm already there.
We've got Micah True, also known as Caballo Blanco, in the studio with us now. Micah, there was a gentleness to these folks that you met at the Leadville 100 running race, and the essence of that is what they call korma. I'm wondering if you could share with us about that.
Korma is a concept. It's a word and a concept in Rarámuri, which means sharing. And the Rarámuri live in a very socialistic fashion, and all of their life involves sharing. A tarahumara will run over the mountains from one village to another or during his travels, and he's offered korima along the way, which is usually aid, food, a cup of pinole, water, a bed, whatever. People just give. And I guess the best way to translate that into English would be it's a circle of sharing. And I sponsor a foot race in the Copper Canyons called the Copper Canyon Ultra Marathon. And the primary sponsor of our race is korima. We share. Everybody shares. Everybody involved shares. And that being the mestizo government of the little village where we make the run, which is on neutral ground. Well, we don't do it in actual tarahumara land. I invite whatever tarahumara want to participate. And we all meet up together on the trail on the way over from one 6,000-foot deep canyon to another 6,000-foot deep canyon to the start of the race. I first started doing this in the early 2000s, and at first it was just myself and a handful of Rarámuri who would fall into the trail and meet me along the way. And when we got to the little village of Orique, I would buy them the nicest hotel in town, and the woman who owns the hotel is a really good cook, and she's a grandma named Grandma Tita, and she said, "Oh, Caballo, this is really cool. You're buying the hotel, I'm going to buy the food." So she cooked us three meals a day for the 3 or 4 days we were in Orique. And then we would all, kind of party down in Orique, and the Rarámuri were treated like champs with respect, which they're not accustomed to being treated this way by mestizo people. And on Sunday, we would line up, and the whole town would line up and watch us leave, and we would race back to the other deep canyon town of Batapiles. It was only 30 miles away, but it was about 15,000 feet of up and down with lots of really rocky trail. We would show up in Batapiles. We would finish our race in Batapiles, and upon arrival in Batapiles, nobody would be there. Only my friends, a couple of my friends who would keep track of who finished and who would write down the names of the finishers. And the Rarámuri, who are my friends, they all live in the deep canyon of Batapiles. And my theory is that as humans, two-legged, confused ones, we tend to appreciate, we tend to desire and want what we no longer have, and that is the case in the Batapiles Canyon. They're just Indians, whereas in the Orique Canyon, where we are treated with champs with respect, there are no longer traditional Rarámuri men anymore. They've faded away. And so it's really special, and it's really a cool thing for Orique to see these people. So anyway, I try to keep the story shorter. One time I ran over to Orique to practice and to organize for the race, and Grandma Tita said, Caballo, we want you to have the race here. What do you want to have the race here? El Presidente wants you to have the race here. And I said, prize money? Okay. Aid stations? Okay. Trail maintenance? Trail maintenance? What's that? We've got all these new roads to run on. And I said, no, we don't want to run on roads. They want to be on the trails, and they've got money to spend. And And, you know, we want to run on trails. And besides, a hotshot journalist from the New York Times is coming, and it'd be bad public relations if somebody ran off trail and died. Okay, trail maintenance, okay. So we started having the race at Orique, and what we began to do was I would invite the Rarámuri from Batapilas, and we'd hike over together, and we'd stay in town and we'd do the race in a couple of loops through town. I designed the course in a Y fashion so that we would always loop back into town and the town could see the progress of the race, and they really embraced it. Last year, when the book was still being written, it was still being edited, and nobody even knew about the book, we had over 200 Rarámuri participants. We gave away $10,000 cash and 62,000 pounds of corn. So I'd say that with or without the book, we're accomplishing what we set out to do, and that is bring respect to the Rarámuri, let the Rarámuri realize that their customs and their traditions and their culture are respected, and for the mestizo people of Mexico who have exploited the Tarahumara to sell tourism for many years, to realize that the Rarámuri are a resource to be cultivated, not a figurehead to be exploited, not something to market tourism by, but to cultivate.
Mike, I think your own spirit is what helped get you down to the Copper Canyon and living among these people. I see the Korima as the aloha spirit, basically.
Oh, sure. I think terminology, aloha, Korima, sharing, these are universal concepts, and it's not one culture above another culture that realizes these concepts. It's something that we all embrace, or we've all had, and some of us in the material world have gotten further away from that as we get reconditioned to life on the reservation.
If someone wanted to contact you or take part in the race, is there one happening?
It's always the first Sunday of March. So this next year will be the 7th of March is the race.
Oh, that's my birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday. You should come down for your birthday
and run.
Or at least hike with us because it's a program of everybody meets in the town of Orique on the 6,200-foot deep canyon on Wednesday evening at Grandma Tita's, the best food you'll ever have, and lots of it. And we all meet together. Some of us hike over from the other canyon. Some of us come down by the train, and we all converge and eat together. The Rarámuri are eating like kings and champions. The gringo participants, we're all eating together and interacting together. The next morning, we all hike slowly one of the 18-mile loops of the course. Then the next following day, Thursday, we all hike the other 18-mile loop of the course. On Saturday is a rest day in which the whole town comes out and they have media presentations and folklorical dance, and they've really embraced all of us as being celebrities and stars. They introduce all of us by our spirit animal helper names that we choose or have chosen for us as we participate in this event. For instance, there's El Coyote and El Venado, which is the deer, and I'm Caballo Blanco, of course. And there's El Oso, Christopher McDougall. I call him Christopher McOso because he's the bear. And, the people really get behind that. Everybody, we have fun with it. Everybody has fun, and that's what it's about. People can contact me at my website, which is caballoblanco.com. So that's white horse in Spanish. Or you can just Google Copper Canyon Ultramarathon, Mike Atreu, Caballo Blanco, or anything. I'm kind of all over the map now. And we do have it. We just began a not-for-profit called Norawas de Rarámuri. www.norawas.org, norawas.org, and that's to begin to raise funds for the Rarámuri so that we can encourage them to, we can provide nutrition and a means to actually practice, because they don't practice, they just get up and run, and they cannot afford the caloric intake necessary to to get up in the morning and run 20 miles for fun. They look at me and they say, muy loco, caballo. You know, why do you run out here and then you have a cup of pinole and you run off again? I mean, what do you do this for? And I say, love. And what the CCUM, CCUM, is all about is a cultural exchange of trail running and party animals. So,
Chris McDougall, author of Born to Run, and Micah True, who shared his life with quite a few of us. For any guest information, to listen to archives and share resources, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.